It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. Hi, I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. So how would you feed 9 billion people? Well, that's the World Bank's tally of how many of us are going to be on the planet by 2050. All right, immediately I think of how many onions I've got to chop. But there are bigger issues here, and a worldwide debate on the answer. For one thing, I wonder if our new cooking stars in 2050 are going to be home cooks, and whether they're going to be from countries that we think of as having little to work with. Well, writer, activist, and scholar Raj Patel believes we need to overhaul from the ground up, starting with how democracy should work. We'll hear from him, talk with you, and much more this hour on The Splendid Table.
This week's Splendid Table is a repeat of an earlier broadcast.
This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. Hi, I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Well, for all the warm fuzzies of how food breaks down barriers and opens up opportunities, there are flip sides. One of them is the question raised by writer Charlotte Druckman in an article that she wrote for the journal Gastronomica. The title was, Why Are There No Great Women Chefs? Charlotte, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Where did this idea come from?
Well, it came from two places. And first was this just act of looking around and feeling that something wasn't quite right, whether it was the James Beard Awards and its lack of equal ratio of awards going out to women and men, and it hasn't shifted that much in the past few years.
Right.
Also, Food and Wine lists its best new chefs every year, and generally there's just one token woman chef, and there are examples of this everywhere. You can see on television sort of the difference between how female and male chefs are presented, and it just made me think, at this point, we're all aware of the fact that women and men can both cook, that talent-wise, it's equal. So how do we get to this point that there's still this discrepancy?
Now, how do you account for, I'm thinking someone like Lydia Bastianich on PBS, Alice Waters, who's famous for so many different reasons, and then all the women of the Food Network,
right.
Where do they fall into your observations here?
I would say, in a way, if you think about it, food is a double-edged sword because it's definitely something that brings people together. But originally, before there was this idea of a métier in food, if you will, there was, the woman cooking at home. So these women that we're calling celebrities are, whether it's of their own choice or, the media is sort of adding onto it, they're getting skewed as sort of the mother of us all, as in Lydia's case, the sort of Nona, the Italian nurturing mother. Alice Waters is quick to say that she's not a chef. She's, just a cook. And her mission is something that's much more one of philosophy and ethics.
Mm-hmm.
And again, these are all stereotypes that we generally associate with femininity. So there's that. I think in Lydia's case, it's really interesting because she owns 4 restaurants, but
yes.
You don't hear about that, and she's written multiple cookbooks, and she's a force, I think, not just as a woman in the restaurant business, but in terms of bringing a certain type of Italian cuisine to America. She doesn't really get credit for it. And I'd add, too, just to turn it back on myself and the rest of us in media, I think even the language that we use sometimes to describe the way that men cook versus the way that women cook, we do, fall back on words like nurturing or homey or comforting when we talk about a woman chef's food, and we'll often describe the same food that a male chef made as, bold, in your face, maybe rustic, and it's inadvertent, but we are playing into this idea of, woman as cook, as home cook, fire
tender. And never as a chef. Never
exactly.
As a pro. What about this idea, because you see this, I see this coming from men much more than women in the food business, but saying that a restaurant kitchen is a very competitive, fierce, difficult place to work. And for a lot of women, this is just not a place that they succeed or that they're comfortable in.
Well, I think you can definitely talk about the fact that it really does, for a lot of restaurants and a lot of women who have experienced life in restaurants, that definitely holds water. There are, you know, some pretty rough circumstances, and there's also a sort of tendency towards fraternity-like behavior in the kitchen, which, you know, if you're a girl, is not easy. But I think the point is more that that has become the template for success. And so if you see other kitchens that are acting, you know, in ways that we would deem unconventional because they don't follow the brigade system or they're not fraternity-like, those kitchens should be getting the same amount of attention as long as the food that they're putting out is just as good, which in many cases it is. So I would spend more time, I think, trying to look at different situations that work as well and put them into the spotlight instead of the argument about how it's not fair that, you know, the average professional kitchen is grueling to women. Because it is, but, you know, it doesn't have to be the only. It's grueling for men, too, and it doesn't have to be the only way.
You know, there's something else you mentioned in the article, and I keep going back to the Food Network because it has such a strong influence. But you said someone did a piece on wardrobe?
Yeah, and it was most upsetting because not only was it in the New York Times, but it was in the New York Times dining section, I believe. And, you know, if it had been a fashion story, it still might have been a little bit silly, and it certainly would have been annoying. But it was considered dining news, which I find really, really fascinating because they were literally talking about the phenomenon of women celebrity chefs wearing V-neck low-cut sweaters. This was A, newsworthy, and B, some sort of breakthrough. And there was no sort of tongue-in-cheek going on in the story either. There was no sort of commentary on, but hey, isn't this ridiculous? It was just the news as it was happening. So it was, A, the fact of the, you know, the V-neck itself is just an indication of how women are dressed on TV when they're cooking versus right. the way men. You'll usually see them in their chef whites.
Almost always in their chef whites.
Yeah. And that goes into the kinds of roles that they're being given, though, as well on their cooking shows. I mean, most of the women on the Food Channel are portrayed as home cooks. They're doing shows in their own home kitchen, whereas the men are competitors or they're in a more professional context.
This is a lot to think about. Charlotte, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Journalist Charlotte Druckman's article, Why Are There No Great Women Chefs?, was published in the winter 2010 issue of the journal Gastronomica. And by the by, Food & Wine magazine has announced their 10 best new chefs for 2010. And once again, as in past years, there are 9 men and 1 woman. Missy Robbins of Avoce in New York City. I think we could use a seasonal moment right about now. Now, there's a recipe that says it all. Midnight asparagus with creamy eggs. Now, the midnight piece of this came out of a very bad, very late meal at a very expensive restaurant. We got home so hungry that the kitchen towels were looking good. So this is the dish that got improvised that night. You flip on the oven to high. You put a sauté pan in it. Get it hot. Pour in some olive oil. Chop up asparagus and drop them in the pan. Give them maybe 3 minutes to roast. Break eggs in the pan, and you're done. The residual heat cooks the eggs, and you finish it off with a squeeze of lemon. Oh, and you've got to have chunks of bread handy. So you run the asparagus through the egg yolks, you dunk the bread at will, and you can find Midnight Asparagus with Creamy Eggs on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're on the site, check out the other recipes. I mean, we've got a whole section of cheap eats. You can sign up for our free weeknight kitchen e-newsletter and download podcasts of the show. What a deal. At splendidtable.org. There's an unusual taste of authentic Greek cooking that I'm seeing more and more of. It's a gum resin called mistiha. Now, we've asked Greek chef and food columnist Diane Kotchilas to explain what this is about. Diane joins us from Athens. Diane, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So what is this?
Mistiha is it's a very interesting spice. It's more than a spice, actually. It's a resin that is drawn from a tree that grows in many parts of Greece, but only produces this resin in the southern part of the island of Chios, which is in the northeastern part of the Aegean.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very interesting substance. It's been known since antiquity both as a spice and for its therapeutic value. The way it's extracted is really fascinating. It's all done by hand. The trees are sliced vertically when the weather is warm. It's always done in the summer.
Right.
And underneath the trees, there's a fine layer of marble dust that's been strewn. And that basically is to keep the masija as clean as possible. And over the course of a couple of weeks, the resin drips out, and it looks like teardrops, slowly making their way down the tree until they fall to the ground. And these are collected and cleaned, and they go through a certain process. They're sorted by size because the drops, of course, are not all uniform in size. And it's a natural chewing gum. That's probably it's what we sometimes call in English. I might be wrong about this, but I think it's sometimes called gum Arabic.
Yeah. I think I'm not sure, but I've heard the term.
They look like little diamonds in the rough. It's a very beautiful spice. It has a very incense-like aroma, very unusual aroma. But what I find most fascinating about masticha is, it's sort of like a chameleon. It marries well with an enormous range of different flavors, from, citrus, to tomatoes. It's delicious with dark chocolate in all sorts of confections. Greeks traditionally use it in holiday breads. That's the most traditional use of it. It's pounded.
But I'd love to know exactly what it tastes like.
What does it taste like? It tastes... It's very difficult to describe. It has an incense-like aroma. It's very... almost otherworldly. It sort of almost has a church smell. I can't really describe it any other way. It's a little bit piney.
Right.
There's a certain density in the aromas of most resins, and masticha definitely has that. There's a certain roundness to it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it's also very refreshing. It's a very clean smell. Very sort of sharp and it's hard to describe flavors.
It almost sounds like if pine scent were to meet sandalwood and musk, it would maybe be something like this.
I think that's a good trio of words.
So now you say, okay, so now we have this solid resin and it's pounded into a powder and then it's blended into things.
Well, yeah, you need to, when you buy it as a, generally you buy it as a crystal.
Right.
In a little packet. It looks almost like a gum packet, a little square box.
Right.
And in order to use that in cooking, it needs to be pounded because it's resinous, it's sticky. So if you put it straight away into something, it'll become, it'll sort of melt and become almost fibrous.
Right.
So you have to pound it. And if you're using it in a dessert or a sweet dish, you pound it in a mortar with a pestle with a little bit of sugar. And if you're using it in a savory dish, you pound it with a little bit of salt. And that just keeps it from sticking to the sides of the mortar.
And then it's blended in.
And then it's added as you would add any spice, depending on the recipe. If you're doing breads, I would usually add it, to my flour, for example.
Uh-huh. So it has a lot of versatility.
It has a lot of versatility. I think that's its most beguiling characteristic, that it's something that you can use in, from salad dressings to chocolate mousse.
Diane, this is great. We're going to have to give this a shot.
You have to try it. It's really wonderful. And you can always just pop a few crystals in your mouth and chew it as a natural gum.
Fascinating. Well, thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Greek chef Diane Kotchilas is author of Masticha Cuisine. Now, you're going to find a recipe for her green olive lentil and masticha tapenade on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to register for this month's book giveaway. Now, this time around, it's a copy of the newest vegetarian tome out of England, Plenty, by Chef Yotam Ottolenghi. Coming up, the future of our dinner plate and the value of nothing with Raj Patel. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. Hi, I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. So what are our dinner plates going to look like 40 years from now? There are going to be 9 billion of us on Earth. And the world is debating the future. Everything is linked. Economics, environment, food, and cultures, and simple answers are not going to do the job. Well, one distinctive voice in these debates is Raj Patel. His background is in world economics and social activism. Patel is a fellow at the Institute for Food and Development Policy and a visiting scholar at UC Berkeley. He's written The Value of Nothing, How to Reshape Market Society and Redefine Democracy. Raj, welcome.
It's good to be here, Lynn.
Raj, I'm looking at a statistic. The World Bank did a study that says that in 40 years, there will be 9 billion people living on this planet. So what do you think is the picture of how we're going to be eating then?
Well, it depends. I mean, right now, there are nearly 7 billion of us, and already 1 billion people are going hungry. Now, some people would say, well, you know, that's because we have too many people on Earth demanding too much stuff of finite resources. But the trouble is that right now we have enough food to feed the world 1.5 times over. The reason people go hungry today is because we don't distribute that food fairly enough. But you're right, in the future, when there are 9 billion people, we will need to start thinking about farming very differently. Because if we continue to farm the way we do today, mm-hmm. people will certainly go hungry. The way we farm today depends on cheap fossil fuel, for example. The average American consumes 2,000 liters of oil equivalent every year, and that's in terms of the transport of the food miles that our food travels, but also in terms of the fertilizer that's used, in terms of the energy that's used mm-hmm. to irrigate land. And in the future, we won't have that. It's very clear that we're past the peak oil. You know, oil will become increasingly expensive, and water will become increasingly expensive. So we're going to have to make some tough choices. There are solutions that involve changes in the way that we farm and changes in the way that we distribute and govern our food system that can manage a population of 9 billion. But we do need to make some fairly deep changes in order for that to happen.
Now, a lot of people advocate that we will all have to be vegetarians. Do you believe in that?
The argument for why we need to be vegetarians is compelling on the face of it, that for every pound of beef, for example, you need 7 pounds of grain in order to raise that beef.
Right.
So there's a certain magnification of the needs of the land that you need in order to produce beef versus grain. And the thing is that, I mean, there are ways in which meat can form part of a sustainable food system. It's just that the way that we produce meat today is absolutely unsustainable. Now, on the other hand, the argument for vegetarianism is that by eating grains, we use less land. But there are ways in which being vegetarian can be incredibly unsustainable. That there are monocultures that are very destructive. For example, in Brazil at the moment, the world's largest soy exporter, the production of soy in Brazil is responsible for a great deal of environmental destruction. So there's nothing sort of magical about the consumer end, about merely making a consumption choice and thinking that things will be better. I mean, mm-hmm. I happen to think that we will need to eat less meat. I think that's pretty clear. But we also need to be asking a deeper question about how things are produced, where they are produced, and through what systems are they produced.
So how do you see that working?
Well, I mean, there are ways of growing food that are much more sustainable. And those involve not monocultures, not row upon row of the same plant,
right,
but instead a much more thoughtful polyculture. Polyculture is when, for example, you grow a crop that you use as a cereal next to a crop that you use as a fertilizer, next to a crop that is that has flowers that attract beneficial insects. Mm-hmm. And so, in fact, it is possible to use some of these very old ideas, but to develop them with cutting-edge science to produce an agriculture system that's much better than the one we have right now, that's much more sophisticated. Because industrial agriculture is really farming for idiots. It's a case of of destroying the ecosystem, and then you have to come back and fix everything that you've just nuked. So you wipe out a robust thing that Mother Nature has given us, and instead we farm with the basic building blocks of add fertilizer, control insects,
right.
And get the crop out.
Sort of the machete approach in one sense.
Absolutely, and you know, it's unsustainable, and there are better ways of doing things.
Right, this is something I'm wondering. When we're talking about changing an agricultural system, I mean, there's a whole economic argument that mm-hmm. comes out of that. But there's another aspect of this. I wonder, are we going to be learning from the countries and the cultures that we view as being poor and deprived? I'm just thinking about how people eat, what they eat, and also maybe how they handle the land.
Well, I mean, I think it would be foolish to say that countries and cultures that have managed their resources sustainably for generations have nothing to teach us when we so clearly have been profligate and infantile in the sort of spoiling of our own resources. And it's very clear that we have been, you know, a number of studies, I mean, most recently in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, suggest that, in fact, the way that we consume is so unsustainable that if the whole world were to consume as much as we do in America, for example, we would need 9 planets in order for everyone to be able to consume the way that we do. Since we only have 1 planet, it would be wise for us to learn from people who also consume within their means rather than consume, you know, excessively as we do. I think globalization, when it is about exchange and about learning from one another, is a very good thing.
It sounds as though you're advocating a system of agriculture and a system of economics that is based on the needs of a people versus the idea of it's there for profit. Mm-hmm. Now, the next assumption I make here is, if this isn't really based on profit, how is it sustainable?
Right now, as I say, we're consuming way more than our fair share of resources. And at the same time, when we're producing more food than we ever have in human history, 1 billion people are going hungry in the world. And even here in the United States, where the most, you know, profit-driven agricultural system ever known is flourishing, this for-profit agricultural system does a very bad job of distributing. And it is possible to figure out ways in which we ensure that the human right to food is met. This isn't to say that people can't be enterprising. There should be enterprise. But there should also be a very firm guarantee from communities and from governments that those who are unable to afford food need to find ways that don't involve the for-profit system in order to be able to get that food. There are many successful examples around the world where that's already happening. I mean, India, the world's largest economy, had a wonderful public distribution system for food that helped stop famine for over 50 years. And sadly, that was in the process of being dismantled for a for-profit system. And you're seeing levels of hunger go up there.
Hmm.
So I think, you know, really the interesting question is not, you know, does for-profit work? But let's explore different ways in which our economy might be set up so that profit is not the only driver of human innovation and exchange. And the good news is, even as recently as last year, when a Nobel Prize in economics was awarded to a woman for the first time for her work on the commons, these ideas are around and they're thriving, and there's a lot for us to learn.
Very interesting. Raj, thank you so much.
Not at all, Lynn. Thank you.
Raj Patel is author of The Value of Nothing, How to Reshape Market Society and Redefine Democracy. Jane and Michael Stern eat their way around America, and they're tracking down those places that still serve the kind of food grandmas used to think they made. They post their finds on their website, roadfood.com, and they stop by with us to report in. Jane and Michael Stern, good to have you two back. Hey, Lynn.
Hi, Lynn. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. So what about you guys? What's been happening?
Well, up to the same old tricks, eating everywhere.
Right.
Especially along I-90, which is the Massachusetts Turnpike. You know, if you're heading west out of Boston, you take I-90. And if you get hungry around West Springfield, which is sort of the big city around there,
uh-huh.
we've got a stop you need to make. It's the White Hut. It's just a hop, skip, and a jump off the highway. And the White Hut has been around since 1939. It is a classic road food joint where you can be in and out, have a wonderful meal in, I would say, 6 minutes or seven, maybe.
I mean, in most places, 6 minutes is what you get to read the menu.
Extremely fast food.
What kind of stuff do they do?
Well, one of the reasons that you can go in fast and get out fast is that the menu is very limited. You can get breakfast there, and I think there may be some sandwiches, but I would say probably 98% of the people who stop at the White Hut get either a cheeseburger with onions or a hot dog.
Which sounds like yawn, yawn, yawn.
Yeah.
But this place is addictive. This place lines around the block. I mean, the hamburgers here, maybe just because it's been there since the 1930s, are legendary.
One of the things that makes these burgers so especially good is the onions. I mean, if you say, I'll have a hamburger, the waitress there will probably correct you and say, you mean cheeseburger, right? And if you say yes, and she said, and of course you want onions on it, right? And you better say yes to that too, because what they do is they sizzle the onions on the grill. So the onions just sop up, you know, years worth of frying hamburgers and are super flavored. And that combined with the melty cheese makes these like just great, inexpensive diner style burgers.
You know, I think there's something about New England. I'm thinking of Lewis Lunch with their strange hamburgers that, you know, you cannot get condiments on, you have to, you know, bun, you can only get toast. Mm-hmm. There's something about New Englanders and their hamburgers which goes against the whole, you know, we'll do it your way mentality.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, you'll do it my way, and that's it, and you better like it.
I do have to say that we have to talk about the hot dogs as well. The White Hat is probably most famous for its hamburgers. However, the hot dogs, I don't know if the dogs themselves are all that special, but the White Hut knows how to make one of those great New England split-top buns.
Like Howard Johnson's originally
Like Howard
did.
Johnson's used to do. You know, where the bun is sort of buttered on each side,
right,
and then cooked on the grill. So the outside gets kind of toasty and crisp and buttery, and the inside is very, very soft. It's the perfect mitt for a good hot dog.
I can picture it. Nobody does those things, right? I mean, this is pretty unusual these days.
It's quite unusual. You do find it in New England. You not only find it for hot dogs, you find it at a few places that serve lobster rolls up along the main coast. They continue to like grill those buns on either side, so you get that really crunchy outside, but the extremely tender inside. It's a wonderful way to do a bun.
You know, I know the White Hut is in Massachusetts, but the state motto of Connecticut is land of steady habits. And I think that's true for all of New England. Once they decide that this is the way they want to serve it, it will be that way forever.
And there's going to be some culinary sociologist out there that will do a dissertation on the study of the buttered bun in
ooh,
New England.
Ooh, can I do that? I want to do that.
Guys, thank you.
Bye, Lynn.
This is a tasty burger.
The latest book by Jane and Michael Stern is 500 Things to Eat Before It's Too Late. Now, you can hear the Sterns here each week, but find their restaurant picks anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, take a look at the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's late.
It is time for us to talk. We are opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252 or go online, splendidtable.org. Let's see, who is up? We've got Tracy calling from Seattle. Tracy, what do you want to talk about?
I would like to talk about International Donuts, Lynn.
This sounds like a new chain.
Well, no, that's a good idea. I hadn't thought about that.
You may have the beginning of a business, but what about International Donuts?
Well, you know, some years ago, Jane and Michael Stern were here in Seattle, and they gave the nod to Top Pod Donuts. which is a marvelous American donut. And it made me think about some of the donuts that I've had in Seattle, one of which is very unusual. And maybe, actually, I think probably many people haven't even heard of it. It's a Filipino donut called Carioca. These are small, round donuts. They are made with glutinous rice flour. And they are typically served on a skewer, and they're crispy on the outside and sugary and then chewy on the inside. And they're just wonderful. I found them actually while I was walking through my favorite Asian grocery store, and they had a little case of donuts, and they had all of these skewers. And, of course, I had to grab one or two or three. Actually,
right, exactly, exactly.
They were wonderful.
You know, that makes so much sense because you think about how rice flour is used throughout much of Asia. And the Pacific. But would they be a bit heavy? Are they leavened?
I don't think they are leavened. It's oftentimes made with a coconut juice or some actual coconut.
Wow.
And then just dropped in small. They're not too big. So, you know, it's not a big, heavy, heavy donut.
Yeah.
And it's the perfect ratio between chewy on the inside and crunchy on the outside.
So tell me more about Seattle donuts.
Well, I have been fascinated by this, and I thought, oh, there's got to be more. And I write for City Arts Magazine, and I thought, wouldn't it be cool to do a story about the array of international donuts we
have
here?
Right, exactly.
And I was absolutely amazed at how many more that we had than I thought. You know, of course, we have beignets, and there are lots of churros here. But,
yeah, which are the Mexican donuts that do look like they're twisted. They're like a twisted stick. You know, now that you're talking about this, I realize something. I think almost every culture that has access to fat probably has some version of the donut. And to figure out where the donut came from, you know, how it got to where it is, and this is what I'm thinking of, my favorite region in Italy, Emilia-Romagna, there's a donut in Parma that is essentially what we would call a jelly donut.
Yes.
Right? And it came from Austria when the Austro-Hungarian Empire dominated northern Italy. And in the early 1800s, Napoleon's wife, his second wife, Marie Louise, became the Duchess of Parma when Napoleon went into exile at Elba. She did not have any interest in spending time with the little guy. She evidently had a lot more interest in going and being the Duchess of Parma. And you can go into, you know, pastry shops there and you eat jelly donuts or cream-filled donuts. And it's all because of that connection. And it's kind of interesting because you could probably trace these donuts that you're finding in Seattle and find wonderful threads and stories behind them.
And that's exactly right. For example, right now, punchki is very popular. That's the Polish donut. And in fact, they're from the Middle Ages in Poland or in that part of the world.
Yeah, because they were always festival food.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you can get the Northern Italy bomboloni here. And then you can get zeppole, which are, you know, from Rome all the way south. And I had some zeppole yesterday with some chocolate sauce, you know, and they're made to order, which...
Chocolate sauce on a zeppole?
Actually, it was a dipping sauce, and I can tell
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. No, Tracy, wait a minute. Hold it a second. This is effetism taken beyond the pale. I mean, chocolate sauce?
Lynn, everything tastes better with chocolate.
I agree with you, but this is a violation of tradition. I'm sorry. But also, I hope the zeppole in Seattle aren't too light, because a zeppole is supposed to sit in your tummy and remind you that you've eaten 2 days later.
Well, this these were not too light. They weren't floating on air, but I did not have any problem this morning, so...
Well, I appreciate the tour, Tracy.
Thank you so much.
I think we've all got to come to Seattle and eat our way through donuts.
Please do. I'd be happy to give you the tour.
Thank you, Tracy. Thanks for calling.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Bye. More of your questions coming up. Connect with us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or give us a call, 800-537-5252. But right now, it's time for our trivia question. Now, this week, the question is, what was Kentucky Fried Chicken's take on charitable giving? Well, we'll be back with that answer and more from you. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. Hi, I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Now, we're going to be back to your calls in a moment. You can join us at 800-537-5252. Connect with us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what was Kentucky Fried Chicken's take on charitable giving? Well, last year, Kentucky Fried Chicken donated sandwich buns and funds to the hungry via food banks. Now, these were very specific buns. They were the buns that were not needed because of KFC's newest product at the time, the breadless sandwich. They called it the Double Down, two fried or grilled chicken patties with bacon, cheese, and special sauce. It has half a day's worth of sodium, a calorie count of a Big Mac, but none of those empty carbs and calories from that white bread bun. Okay, it's back to you and your calls and emails. Now remember, anything goes. You can reach us at 800-537-5252 or at splendidtable.org. Brandy's on the phone from Jackson, Tennessee. Brandy, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I called about cooking with ghee.
The clarified butter.
Exactly. The annoying butter that takes 20 minutes for about 2 tablespoons worth.
Yeah, that. Oh, that.
I just bought a Indian cookbook, and of course, almost every single dish in it, it says, you know, begin with ghee.
Right.
But then in parentheses, it says, you know, you can use vegetable oil or extra virgin olive oil.
I don't know if I'd use extra virgin olive oil because I don't think it ever existed in India. But anyway, okay. All right. A little disagreement here. Yes. But go on.
And I was just wondering, you know, how important is it to use ghee, or is it just really one of those things, you know, you can use vegetable oil, you don't have to make this stuff, or am I never going to get the authentic taste and flavor if I don't use it?
I think, first of all, it depends where in India the recipes come from. And I don't consider myself a great expert on Indian food, but I know there are parts of India, especially in the south, where coconut oil might be used or other oils, palm oil. The key here is ghee has a delicious flavor. There's no question about it. But there's also the concern over saturated fats. I think when the ghee is a big part of the recipe, yeah, you want to use ghee. Now, you could cut it with something like an expeller press canola oil. In so many words, a healthy oil that is relatively flavorless, and you use maybe half and half.
Okay.
But I do a lot of Indian-inspired cooking, and I use things like canola. And I don't think I'm sacrificing a great deal of flavor. Oh, now, I know Indian cooks might be jumping up and down right now, but between the spicing and all the other techniques that are used in the cooking, like, you know, you make a flavor paste maybe of garlic and spices and onion, and then you fry it in fat until almost all the moisture is evaporated and it's just those spices and those flavorings starting to, you know, saute in the oil. That does so much for flavor that if that oil were flavorless, it's not going to make a big, big difference. So it depends.
Okay.
The short answer is it depends on the recipe. If it's mainly ghee and not a lot of other ingredients, yeah, I'd say go to the trouble to use ghee. And by the way, ghee keeps for a long time. So you could do, you know, several pounds of butter. And you could freeze part of the ghee or keep it in the refrigerator. A lot of people just keep it at room temperature. I refrigerate it. But it's going to keep for quite a while.
Oh, well, that helps me a lot.
Yeah,
I definitely
yeah.
don't mind making it if it's going to keep.
And freeze it in small quantities so that, you know, you can pull out. One of the tricks I used to use with it was I would put it in the old-fashioned ice cube trays. And then I could...
That's so neat.
I'd pop out the frozen cubes and throw them in a plastic bag. And put that in the freezer, and then I could pull out, because an ice cube is generally about 2 tablespoons.
It's like individually packaged.
Exactly. So if you can find an ice cube tray with, you know, more or less a standard size ice cube. By the way, you can do that with egg whites, because the average egg white is 2 tablespoons. That's what you get from a large egg, which is a pretty standard measurement in cooking. And so you can just pop your frozen egg white out, and off you go. So that should help you. That should help you out.
definitely. You've helped me a lot. You've answered so many questions in this 5-minute conversation. Well, thank you, Liz.
Well, thank you.
I appreciate it. I love the Splendid Table. I love NPR. I want to work for NPR someday. So,
well, thank you. Thank you for the kind words. Bravo. Thank you.
You have a great day.
You too. Take care, Brandy. Bye.
Bye.
By the way, ghee is made by essentially melting butter. Okay. And what happens is the natural oil in the butter separates from the solids and you get this golden liquid. And then you just let that liquid cook until those solids start to turn golden and they give it a wonderful flavor. And then you let it cool and you just skim off the solids and you really have solids at the bottom, solids at the top. And in the middle, the clear oil is the ghee. It freezes beautifully. No problem. You can reach us at 800-537-5252 or go online, splendidtable.org. We have Amy on the phone from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Amy, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I was wondering if you have any fantastic coleslaw or potato salad ideas. My friend is having a fish fry, and he's caught all this bluegill and smelt and salmon and perch. And so, yeah, it's a pretty big deal, and this is the first year that I get to go to the party, and I really want to make it fantastic.
Well, you know, we're working on a new book, and we just came up with a coleslaw recipe.
All right.
And essentially what it is it's a homemade ranch dressing.
Okay.
With, you know, shredded cabbage and shredded red onion. And as I remember, I think there was some shredded carrot, but it was mainly the red onion and the cabbage.
Okay.
And then what we added to it was Spanish smoked paprika.
Nice.
Which is hot or sweet. You can go either way. And you warm that paprika just a little bit in a little bit of oil because it really helps it blossom. I mean, it's literally... you know, like a teaspoon of oil and a teaspoon of the paprika in a pan, and you put it over medium heat for maybe 3 minutes or until you can smell it, and then you just scrape it into the dressing.
Nice.
So the basic premise here is that you want to make the dressing, which would be starting out with – I always start out with olive oil and vinegar.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And I use equal parts. So I might use 1/4 cup of vinegar and 1/4 cup of olive oil.
Okay.
Mashed garlic.
Yum.
Okay. I mean, to whatever degree you like. I like garlicky anything, so mm-hmm. I'll put in maybe 2 or 3 cloves. And I'll throw that into the food processor. And then what I add to that is, let's say for argument's sake, 1/2 cup of buttermilk.
Okay.
1/2 cup of mayonnaise and 1/4 cup of sour cream. Now, with that combination, you can go anywhere.
Yeah, that sounds really like a nice basis.
Yeah, and that's basically a ranch dressing. And then what you do is, and I do it in the food processor because it just happens very fast. I do 1 handful of parsley leaves, and I do 2 of whole scallions. Mm. And you throw that in, and a little bit of mustard and a dash of Worcestershire to taste.
Worcestershire.
Yeah, and a basil never hurts either.
Okay.
and then the night before, this is what you put with the smoky paprika, and I like it hot. You put that over your very finely shredded cabbage and some thin sliced red onion, and you let it sit overnight, and then you drain it because you know how how much water cabbage can throw off.
Right, right.
But
yeah.
But it's delicious if you leave it sit overnight, and it's really, really tasty.
Cool. I also wonder, I'm seeing a lot of recipes for like a jicama and fennel salads too. Or
oh, those are wonderful.
And is it just, like with the fennel ones, I'm just seeing like a lot of, very thinly sliced down the mandolin and then some like orange zest and orange juice.
You got it. It's oil and vinegar, right? I mean, you can do this any way you want. If you want to get fancy, it can be oil and sherry vinegar because this is done a lot. In Spain, and the orange zest, and another thing that's wonderful when you're doing the jicama and the fennel, because they're both sort of sweet, is to have some coarse chopped pitted black olives. like, you know, the shriveled oil-cured olives or Kalamata olives.
Yeah,
it's really delicious in that combination.
Great. Okay? So well, thank you so much.
You are welcome, and have a great fish fry.
Thanks. I'm looking forward to it, and we'll let you know how your recipe works out.
Please do.
All
give
right,
us a call.
Thanks so much.
Okay. Hey, thanks. You take care, Amy.
You too. Bye, Lynn.
Bye. You can reach us 800-537-5252 or go online, splendidtable.org. Okay, we have got Erin calling from Boston. Erin, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I love your program. It's wonderful to get the chance to talk to you. I'm calling because I have a question about lemons. I've always really enjoyed lemons, and my brave and wonderful husband decided to buy us a small lemon tree, even though we live in Boston.
How great!
Yes, he's phenomenal. So we've been cultivating it indoors and on our porch, and I almost killed it, but he has nurtured it back to health, and now we've got three beautiful, ripe Meyer lemons.
Oh my.
So
oh, that's wonderful.
The kind of thing I usually do with lemons is, you know, add lemon zest to salads or side dishes or use lemon juice on sauces or condiments. Mm-hmm. But I want to do something a little more special with this wonderful gift, and I was hoping maybe you'd have some ideas for me.
Oh, you know what first comes to mind? And I'm not sure even where it's from. It may be North Africa, maybe Spain. Who knows? It may be the Middle East. With Meyer lemons, because Meyer lemons tend to have a touch of sweetness to them.
Yeah.
And they're really delicious. And since these are your three lemons from your own lemon tree, I don't want to see you waste anything. I mean, I'd even save the pits and put them in the soil and see if you can sprout more lemons.
Yeah, that'd be great.
But what I would do is, why not take those lemons and slice them paper thin? Okay. Spread them out on a platter, sprinkle them with sugar, okay, and a little bit of salt, and let them sit. And then this is a lemon salad.
Oh, okay.
And then what you do is you can put – their juice will make the acid, okay, because they'll throw off a bit of juice. But then what you do is you sprinkle them with a really tasty olive oil, a little bit of black pepper. Okay, and if you want, a little bit of thin sliced onion and fresh mint leaves.
Ooh, that would be beautiful.
I think it could really be interesting. And the idea is that you're putting enough sugar on the lemon. It's not a heavy amount, but it's a fairly generous amount of sugar. So that's going to be blending with the bitterness you get in the rind and that bit of salt. Then the oil and the black pepper, it forms this beautiful contrast. And what you're really doing is you're back in the Arab world in the medieval period when the food was absolutely incredible. You put that next to a piece of grilled fish or a little lamb and you will just be in heaven.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. How long do I need to let it sit? Does it need to...
A couple hours. Yeah. Yeah, and you can serve it at room temperature. And, you know, you can overlap them. You can make it as pretty as you want to make it, but thin, thin, thin slices. And you'll get the real taste of the lemon at the same time.
Oh, great. Oh, that sounds wonderful.
Enjoy.
I will. Thanks so much.
You are welcome. Take care. You can reach us at 800-537-5252 or online, splendidtable.org. Brenda Tan and Matt Gross are high school students in New York City. They did a four-month project that mapped their neighborhood in a way that no cartographer would recognize. And in the process, they may have made a significant new discovery, too. Well, Brenda is on the phone. Brenda, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, you're welcome. Now, explain what the project was.
Okay, so our project is called DNA House. Basically, we studied DNA barcoding, which is a method to identify species based on their DNA sequences.
Right.
So Matt and I collected 217 samples from local supermarkets and our homes. And so we tested anything we thought might have animal DNA, such as beef jerky, dried soup mix.
Ah, so were there any surprises with all the food testing?
Yes, actually. We found that DNA in 11 out of 66 foods were mislabeled. So that was a big flag.
So you're saying what was on the label was not what the food was about.
Right.
Some examples. Which kinds of things?
Some of the pricier items. Sheep's milk cheese actually just was made from cow's milk. And another one, sturgeon caviar was Mississippi paddlefish.
Mississippi paddlefish is a lot cheaper to get than sturgeon caviar. That's really interesting. Anything, for instance, dried soup mix, that kind of thing, were there any surprises there?
It was surprising that we were able to get DNA from it at all. I think Matt and I were probably one of the first students to test butter, and we were able to get cow DNA from that.
Huh. This is really interesting. For you two as students, did you expect what you found? Did you expect the food products that were not labeled correctly?
Not at all. Two students did a project before us called Sushi Gate, where they studied fish in markets, and they found some mislabeling. So I guess Matt and I expected some things to be mislabeled, but It was a pretty big percent.
Yeah, and I keep thinking about those very expensive things that are
right.
That turn out not to be made with very expensive ingredients. Really interesting. So does this mean you're going to aim toward working in genetics?
I have studied genetics in high school, but I'm going to study biology in college.
Can't wait to see what you're going to be doing in a couple of years. Hey, Brenda, thanks for taking the time to talk with
Thank
us.
Thank you.
Brenda Tan is a student at the Trinity School in New York City. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Now remember, you can call us anytime. The number's 800-537-5252. You have a great week, and let me leave you with this thought from Andreas Lerch, who said, "Nothing is what it seems." Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media. Now, you'll find information on nearly everything you heard here today on our website, splendidtable.org. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Judy Boudreau. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. The website is managed by Sarah Lear and Steve Cornier. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. We'll be back next week. You have a great one. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.